All right, we're in RX World again. Bart, how are you, man?
Very good. How about you, Charles?
Great. That's a great shirt.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Yes. You know?
You always have cool shirts
actually,
for your Channel 9 interviews.
The person in the bakery actually asked me whether it contains all the digits of pi, so I had to explain that pi doesn't have a limited number of digits.
Exactly. But it contains a lot of them.
A lot of them, yes.
Perfect.
More than she actually knew.
So congratulations again for the RX release.
Mm-hmm. Thank
you. You're getting very well received. Your workshops are being... challenges are being done.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the downloads are going crazy as well. So
excellent, good. Man. So, I wanted to come here today and talk to you about a different X. This would be mm-hmm. IX.
Yep.
Interactive extensions. Mm-hmm. What's going on?
Yeah. So most of the miners will have seen us, you know, talk about interactive extensions like a year ago or 1.5 years ago. So if you sort of look at the evolution of RX, right? RX sort of came out of dualizing the world of enumerable. So you basically took enumerable and you have standard query operators, and those make sense for observables as well. Other than a couple. Like if you really look at, you know, the link to object set of operators, you will find most of them live in RX as well, other than the set operators like except, union, intersect, those kind of things, because you need to know the whole stream before you can do something. And same with order by, like those do not exist in RX, but the main portion actually exists. Now, the opposite direction, if you start from RX, you know, you sort of define more operators, and of course a lot of those make sense for enumerables as well. Mm. So IX is basically the extensions to link to objects that allow you to, you know, use some of those RX primitives also in the world of enumerables.
Mm.
Now, there's a big, you know, sort of but in there, like, you know, we don't really port all of the operators because some of them, you know, are kind of intrinsic to the nature of RX. Mm. Like you have things like time notions, those kind of things do not quite make that much sense. So maybe I should give an example here,
yes.
Right? You know, of one of those things. So if you go through the evolution of IX, we sort of had an initial release maybe almost 2 years ago or 1.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We did the initial port, you know, of some of the RX operators to interactive extensions. And we sort of went totally bananas there. Like we said, like we can dualize everything because it's just, you know, it's substituting our enumerable and our observable and you get the opposite thing, right? So a good example is the AMP operator from RX, the ambiguous operator. So basically if you have AMP for two observable sequences, what it means is let the two sequences race to produce the first result. And then that sequence that actually is the first to respond wins the race.
Okay.
So say that you have two stock tickers or two, you know, two markets, you know, that you're trading something on, like the first bid sort of wins. Like that could be one of the things. So say that you have X's and Y's, you do M between them. Really what happens is like we subscribe to both sources, and then the first one that comes back with a result, you know, produces results to the outputs.
Okay.
Now the thing is like the intrinsic thing, that sort of the implied thing in there is that observables can actually race with each other. Because, well, if you do a subscribe, you immediately return, and you're asynchronous. Like, you know, you do a subscribe, and the thing is off doing its stuff, right? And you can subscribe to the second source, and third source, and so on. So if you amp, like, 100 sources together, you can really make them go concurrently. So you don't need to introduce more concurrency to make it happen. Now, if you want to do that for enumerables, well, you have a big problem. Like, you know, you have two sequences, two I enumerables, and you want to make them race for each other. Say that you have two queries that come from link to SQL,
mm-hmm.
one link to SQL that lives in Australia, and one link to SQL replica that lives in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to make them race for each other, like, to get the first results.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't really call inside the AMP operator for enumerable. You can't really call get the enumerator, move next on the first one, and then do it on the second one, because the first one will block till the results are available, so there is not really any race going on, it's just sequential.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to introduce concurrency to make that work. So originally we did that, like we said, we take a dependency on this assembly called system core X, where our schedulers used to live, and the AMP operator can take in an iScheduler, and we can basically take the enumerables and make them some kind of, you know, concurrent enumerables by introducing the iScheduler. But really, it turns out that the thing you're doing there is something you can do manually as well.
Hmm.
Like you could say, I have two enumerables, we have an operator called toObservable. to basically make them into observables. And that's parameterized by a scheduler to make, you know, the iteration of that particular enumerable go somewhere in the background. So you can equally well do the AMP operator between two enumerables by first going to observables, do the AMP operator there, and then go back to an enumerable. So you don't really need the, you know, built-in operator AMP inside the enumerable world.
Okay.
Though you can. Like, you know, it's a good exercise, like, for the miners to sort of implement, you know, the AMP operator.
Okay.
Just in terms of enumerables and iScheduler. And you
cool.
will actually find it's a little subtle, you know, in the Cortex. But overall, you know, it's doable, and we did at some point. But so in the new release of iX, we don't do those kind of operators that need to introduce concurrency.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can equally well take the sequence and move it to the observable world and do your magic there.
Okay.
Same with time-based operations. Like, you know, you have an enumerable and you want to time it out if, you know, nothing comes back within a certain time window.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to do that, you need to run a timer. How do you parameterize on where the timer runs? The answer is use an iScheduler. And you're already sort of going, you know, off into some land that's not really the native land of enumerables.
Mm.
So you can equally well say, well, take the sequence, do two observable, and then you have the time-based operations of, you know, Rx that you can use.
Okay.
And after that, you can come back to an enumerable if you still want that. But
mm-hmm.
like if you do time-based operations, most likely you want to be asynchronous anyway. So, you know, it's good to sort of push it over to the observable land in that case.
So going into the usage of the term interaction and interactive
mm-hmm.
versus reactive. So can you explain a little bit? I mean, I understand what you just taught us.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear. But I want to know why you chose the term interactive.
Okay, yeah.
Interactive,
mm-hmm.
why?
Okay, it's sort of like it's the relationship between the application
mm-hmm.
and the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so, in the reactive world, it's your application that reacts to things coming from the environment.
Yes.
In the interactive case, it's the, you know, application that's interacting with the environment. So,
mm-hmm.
it's like dualizing the English words as well, if you will. You could call it, you know...
So, interactive is the dual of reactive.
Yes, that's, you know, our interpretation of English.
Okay, that's your
interpretation. That's not my native language, so, you know, I have to believe people there.
Fair enough.
But so that's the basic idea. Yeah.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
so in reality, you know, let's take it back down to,
mm-hmm.
I'm a developer, I'm implementing a solution, when, you know, I'm going to choose to use interactive extensions. I mean, the great
yep.
thing about reactive extensions is that I can just send out all of these workloads and not worry about them, continue
yes.
on with my computation
mm-hmm.
sequentially, or at least my thinking
yep.
in terms of composition.
Mm-hmm.
In the interactive world, it sort of goes back to the, instead of Eric Meyer throwing stuff at me,
yeah.
I have to ask him.
Yes, exactly. It's
okay.
the move next world of enumerables.
Mm-hmm. I got it. So it's all
yeah.
about the move next world of enumerables.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So let's dig yeah. in a little more.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe now I've sort of explained the things we don't have.
Yes.
Like, which we had before. What are the things that are still in there that people would like to use,
yes.
right? So a number of, you know, families of operators, and I will sort of start with the ones that I don't really have to explain much, and then we'll go
mm-hmm.
do some whiteboarding for the more exciting ones. Right?
Good.
So a set of the operators that we have are the imperative operators. Let's start with those. Like, if people know the workflows in F#, the, you know, workflow builders and all of that, you can basically lift parts of your syntactic, you know, programming, you know, using ifs and whiles and all of that stuff into operators. So we've done that in Rx with, you know, the experimental releases. We have like if and while and do while and all of those kind of operators sitting in there to do sort of imperative style coding on top of those sequences. So we have exactly the same in Ix.
Okay.
That's something that you might want to use, but it's like, it's kind of, you know, a corner case in some sense, because you're sort of already starting in the world of expressions, right? You know, like you're talking about link expressions, and like the imperative constructs feel like a little bit upside down, because like it's imperative, it's typically a statement kind of world, and you're lifting them into operators. But so they're there for, you know, completeness, and we've seen people actually use them quite extensively in Rx as well. Especially if you come from an imperative world, like that might be a nice mindset for people to think in terms of.
Mm.
So we have those. Then we have the exception operator. So those are already the ones that, you know, when I did the poll on the RX forum, like, what are the things you like about interactive extensions, people said, please give me the exception operators back. Like, the history here is, like, we had, you know, a little black zone in the releases of, you know, RX and IX. Like, typically they were sort of in tandem with each other. When we actually migrated the whole RX build system to a different system, and we sort of prepared for the final release of RX, we didn't have the bandwidth to port IX at the same time, so we did a little poll on the forum in the meantime to ask, like, what are the things you would like definitely to be in RX. One of the things that came up is definitely the exception operators. So say that you have a sequence that throws an exception upon doing a move next. Well, maybe you want to catch that exception and not really write like a try-catch block, because like a try-catch block would cover all the code inside the for each loop. Like, you just want to catch, you know, the exception coming out of the move next, then if you would have to do that manually, well, you really have to go to get the enumerator with a using statement, and you can't even use a while loop because the move next needs to be in a try-catch block and all of that. So enumerable dot or enumerable ex dot catch basically allows you to catch exceptions that come out of the iteration and substitute them for a catch sequence that basically substitutes, you know, the sequence that was in flight at the point of the exception with some new sequence, which by itself could throw, of course. And so it's really like the same control flow as a, you know, try catch for statements. It's now a try catch for iteration. Same in RX, it's exactly the dual in this case. Like, there's no different cases, it's really the same kind of catch logic in terms of the data flow. So we have things like finally in there, using, like, you know, all the things that have to do with exceptions in CLR and C# and VB, on our resume next for the VB Fox. So, you know, we have those operators all sitting there.
Interesting.
So those are pretty useful, like, if you have sequences that talk to, say, for example, the network. Do a link to SQL thing, things can happen at any point in time during the iteration. And if you want to basically still bind that sequence to the UI but not have the exception pop out and do something else instead, you can use the catch operator for that. Or on IRB Zoom next, like, if you say something goes wrong, I can basically fall back to a new sequence and just continue going.
Okay.
You can use those constructs.
Cool. And you could also implement sort of your own atomic operators.
Yep.
In some sense. I mean, because that would be a great thing to be able to guarantee that if it doesn't all complete, then heck with it, let's do it again.
Oh, yes. It all down. Exactly. Yep. So that's actually the retry operator.
Excellent.
It's actually the one that's closest to what you describe here.
Yeah.
So,
beautiful.
So, yep, we have a lot of those guys. So those were very useful. People liked those. I like them a lot as well.
Yeah, you're really into operators.
Yeah.
Sort of
operator
overload.
Sort of the operator.
It's true, man.
Building those guys.
But let me ask you, what is it about operators that, that you're so into?
It's really about, like, the minimum kind of thing that people need to write. You know, like, it's a very small API surface, but a lot of, you know, stuff can go behind it, and you can still sort of say what goes behind the scenes. Like, it's like an operator is pretty well defined. Like, you know, it's a where operator or a select, and you can basically describe the thing, even though the implementation can be quite complex and subtle. You have a lot of abstractions where you have the tip of the iceberg thing and the rest is mystery below it. Like, even if you look at it, like, you can't really figure out, like, what the thing is doing, like, because it goes into la-la lands.
Sure.
So operators are really, like, some kind of sweet middle ground where you sort of stay in the very algebraic world of composition, and then you have those, you know, nice, you know, implementations below that typically go in terms of other operators.
Sure.
So, like, you know, combine five operators, you have a new one. So it's like, it's like a pyramid scheme.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
It's very compositional.
Yeah, exactly.
One quick question before we continue with the IX, or, I mean, whatever happened to iQzerable? I think the name killed it, man.
It's still in there.
I know, but is anybody using it? I mean, is it too...
Because
somebody had asked on the on Channel 9, you're like, whatever happened to iQzerable?
Okay,
so what happened to it?
Have
you
done
anything?
Things.
Good.
Yeah, so iQzerable, just to set the scene a little bit, right, is the it's a dual to iQueryable that allows you to write expression tree-based queries on top of reactive streams. So that allows you to basically translate queries into target domains. Now, it turns out there are not that many query languages for, you know, asynchronous and push-based streams today. Mm-hmm. Like, a good example is linked to WQL for WMI events, like we have a sample for that. Where you really take, you know, your observable query and turn it into WQL statements, you give it to the WMI infrastructure, somewhere deep in the kernel that thing gets executed, and then asynchronously results come back, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are far more, you know, query languages in the pool-based world, and that just happens to be, you know, a network kind of thing, or, you know, like a provider kind of thing. Like, SQL is really pushing things on a TCP socket using TDS, but it happens that people have traditionally always gotten to the information by doing pool-based things. So iQuery will make a lot of sense there.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of things we did is, like, first of all, iQObservable is not in the main assembly anymore. It's actually refactored into system reactive providers, which is a separate assembly, so it's less visible in some sense, but it's basically done to separate things out much nicer. Like, there are certain platforms that don't have expression trees or all the stuff that's required, so we need to have a separate assembly there. Now, at the same time, we're internally using it quite a bit for some projects we're working on right now,
Excellent. Which
I can't really talk about much, but so, yeah, it's if you want to describe, you know, those push-based queries and you want to sort of capture the computation and do rewrites of expression trees and move them across to different nodes, like that kind of thing, you know, or translate them into some target language, then we want to use that. Like, a good example would be somebody writing, you know, link to Twitter. Like, link to Twitter, you want to have the where clause execute on Twitter. Like, you know, the hashtag filtering needs to happen there. You don't want to get the whole Twitter stream to your machine just to toss out 99.99% of it.
Sure.
Right? So that's where you would actually write an iQObservable to take, in that case, just the where portion and run it somewhere else.
Interesting. Cool.
So actually, that brings to an excellent point, because in iX, we actually did some work with expression trees as well,
okay,
which we didn't do before. So one of the things is, and then we'll also talk about buffers and subjects, those kind of things, but, like, because we want the observable train, let's continue there. So one of the things we didn't really have in interactive extensions is the ability to capture those new operators, like, you know, the catch operator that we talked about, retry, on our resume next, the ones I will talk about in just a moment. Like, all those operators, you can't really capture in an expression tree, because, like, there is no queryable equivalent to those operators. Like, queryable, the interface used for link to SQL and those kind of providers. So iX was sort of, you know, giving you the enumerable implementation of those guys, but you couldn't interpret it if you would like to write a query provider that says, I can recognize enumerable.ex.retry and I can move it to some other, you know, place to compute it, like using some SQL dialect or whatever. So one thing we introduced in interactive extensions this time around is actually system.interactive.providers, which basically has a class called queryable.ex that basically has all of those operators in the queryable world as well. So you can capture them as expression trees and write query providers that support those guys. So that's an extension to queryable. And some interesting things to actually notice there. The way that queryable works with regards to what we call the local provider. So one of the things you can do in queryable is you have a local sequence of enumerables, like, say, a list of T, which is an enumerable of T. And you want to write an expression tree-based query on top of that. You can say, well, I have my list, I do S queryable, then I write my whole query, which is now captured as expression trees. The reason you might want to do that is you might want to look at the expression tree and optimize it using an expression tree rewriter or something. And at the end, you say S enumerable and you do a for each loop. You could have done everything without the S queryable and the S enumerable part, right? You could have left that out and sort of just written your entire query on top of the list. But in this case, you want to capture the expression tree so that you can rewrite it and do manipulation on top of that. So you insert S queryable, S enumerable. Now, the thing that the S enumerable does is something that, you know, I invite the miners to think about. The S enumerable really needs to say, well, you had an expression tree that represents the entire query here. Now the user wants to for each over that. Like, typically you take an expression tree and turn it into some other language, right? Like T-SQL or, you know, whatever the query language is, like Camel in SharePoint or LDAP or any of those guys.
Mm.
Now, in this case, there's no point in doing that because it's, like, really about a local list of T. So the S-enumerable that actually sits in systemlink.enumerable in the BCL actually does a lot of voodoo behind the scenes to take the expression tree and basically rewrite the expression tree to retarget all the queryable operators in there to their enumerable brothers. So basically the whole thing gets dot compiled using the DLR infrastructure, you know, of expression tree compilation to a local executing query. So now the question is, if you have your own operators, you know, your own queryable set of operators that live in a different assembly, how does that as enumerable thing know where to look for the enumerable counterpart of that guy? Because, like, given any iQueryable-based operator, you can find the enumerable-based one. It's just substitute the interface names. So how does it find that? And the answer is it just looks next to it. It just looks for a method that sits next to the queryable one. That's the way the resolution works. So you will find in system.interactive.provider some stubs that actually satisfy the as enumerable rewriter to basically go to the enumerable equivalents that live in system.interactive. So there's a little bit of, you know, jumping around happening there.
Sure.
But it actually just works. So that's
nice.
That's a nice thing. Now, out of that fell some other thing that actually we learned. That's sort of, you know, the pendulum swinging from Rx to Ix and back. Initially, we took operators from Ix, or, you know, from link to objects to Rx, and then we sort of went back, and, you know, as we did that, we also learned something about the query provider infrastructure when we did Rx. And that's actually, I've explained that in the observable video some time ago.
Yeah.
The thing is, you have some of those operators that are source generators, like enumerable.range is a good example, right? Enumerable.range, it's not an operator that takes in any input. It's not, you know, a unary operator or a binary operator. It's really, you know, a nullary operator, you know, that doesn't have any inputs other than two constants, like, you know, the start and the number of elements to generate. So the question is, like, if you write a queryable kind of equivalent for that, like, where does the range get generated? Like, you can't really say link to SQL.range from 0 to 10, even though in SQL you might actually be able to compile that into something that generates the number 0 to 10. Like, there's no convenient place to say where it needs to happen, because you don't have a table you're dotting off to. Like, you're not saying, you know, products.range, like, that doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't have a left-hand side that you sort of can pull the provider out of. So in Rx, we solved that issue by actually putting operators, those, you know, operators that don't have an input side, on the query provider.
Mm.
So you have the iQobservable provider, which is like the provider interface next to iQobservable, and you can dot into that guy for all of those operators that do not have, you know, a clear left-hand side or a clear input side. So like range is a good example. So with that, you can write things like link to PowerShell. Like, if you do link to PowerShell, they have a way to generate a push-based range. You can actually write in PowerShell, you can write 0.9. And 0.9 is the thing at the pipeline that generates the number 0 through 9.
Hmm.
Like, that's really observable.range 0.9. It's really the same thing.
Hmm.
Now, how do you translate that? Well, basically, the user can write in there, like, you know, PowerShell.provider, which is an iQobservable provider, and then do .range 0.9. And then that goes to the link to PowerShell provider that knows how to interpret the range operator to translate it into 0.9. Mm. Like, that's the syntactic translation that needs to happen. But now it can be done, because, like, in the enumerable world, you don't have that option, because, like, enumerable.range, enumerable.empty, enumerable.return, well, that's on an IX, like, those do not have a provider as the input.
Interesting.
So what we did with IX this time around is in system.interactive.providers, we've provided those as well.
Great.
So you can do, like, queryable ex.provider.range 0.10. And if you write your own provider, like the link to SQL provider, they would expose the provider object, and they would implement, you know, something inside link to SQL that understands the range operator or the empty operator, they could basically translate those queries into the target domain as well.
Excellent.
So that's something you have to look for, like if you're into writing query providers, that is. So,
right on. Well, I'm sure there's people out there into writing query providers.
Oh, yes, yeah. There's pretty big ecosystem on link providers. So that's kind of a new dimension sort of in there. For those things that sort of generate things out of thin air.
Well, I mean, that's sort of what you're famous for. I mean, before you came to the RX team, you had written, you know, that's where we did the first link to everything.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And that's still a dream that you're still pursuing.
Oh, yes, we're still
link to everything
doing things there. Yeah.
Is real.
It's real, yes.
Link to everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Awesome, man.
Mm-hmm.
So it's time for the whiteboard.
Yes, let's actually talk about the binding operators.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, actually, just setting the scene first,
and
we'll draw some pictures here. So in RX, you know, all the operators live on observable, right? You know, observable dot. But internally, in our source code system, things are sort of split out in different partial classes, partial files.
Okay.
You know, just for organization. And one of the files is called observable.binding.cs. And so the operators that live in there, which, of course, you don't see in the assembly because everything gets compiled together, but the operators that live in there are those things like let, publish, multicast, replay, groom. Those operators live in that file.
Okay.
And there's something special about those guys because they are really about, you know, taking an observable sequence and reusing it multiple times and enforcing some policy on how that needs to be done with regards to caching values, reevaluating side effects, all those kind of things. And that's actually one of the original things. Like on my blog a long time ago, I implemented enumerable.let, which is like about reusing a sequence without duplicating the side effects of enumeration. So I will actually write a sample on the whiteboard in just a moment that actually shows that. But so we've done some work on the RX side for those operators. Actually, the latest iterations of those operators all boil down to the same common operator called multicast that uses subjects behind the scenes to enforce the policy. So like publish, prune, replay, let, you know, but let is kind of a special one because it doesn't do much. But, you know, the other guys basically are shorthand syntax for multicast with a certain subject.
Interesting.
So there is this common notion of a subject across all of them. And the question is, is there some equivalent concept in interactive extensions that would make sense? Historically, we didn't have that. So in this release, you will actually see the first kind of signs of something brewing there, like to sort of, you know, find the abstraction. And let's actually talk about it on the whiteboard.
Great. Right. And this is, to be clear,
yep,
in the experimental release.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah.
Just so people understand.
So for RX, it's in the stable release. So RX, actually, all the binding operators are in the stable release. Mm-hmm. For interactive extensions, there is only an experimental release today. So IX doesn't have a stable release because we are noodling around with things quite a bit.
Yeah. Excellent.
So let's take a look at the problem that we sort of are talking about here. So so let's actually write the canonical example of a side-affecting sequence, right? So say that I have some random number generator, sand equals u random. Let's make it static. So I have just a single, you know, s underscore rand, which is a random number generator sitting here.
Okay.
And now I want to write, you know, an enumerable sequence that generates random numbers, just an infinite set of them, right? So I can write something like static ienumerable, I will just abbreviate that, int, and I will call this thing random, like this. And what we'll do is we'll just do while true, yield return srand next. Okay, so I just have an iterator sitting here that you can do move next on, and it just generates random numbers every time you do move next.
Okay.
So I have this guy sitting here. Now the question for the miners, well, actually I will answer it myself at some point, but you know,
The question to ask here is, like, if I use that sequence multiple times, what happens, right? Like, if I write something like this, say var axis equals random, and let's say just take 10 to make it finite, right? So I get 10 random numbers here. Notice this thing is lazy. At this point, this thing doesn't execute. Like, there are no 10 numbers being taken yet. Like, I haven't done a to list on this guy to start the enumeration. It's only when I do a for each it will generate random numbers. So I could write for each x and x as a new console write line, and I could do it the second time, and I will see different numbers, of course, because there are different iterations. Now, say that you want to compose x's with something else, like you want to write some query. Let's say var y's equals x's dot zip with x's, comma, x, comma, y, or let's do l, comma, r for left and right. Left and right goes to left divide by right, something like that.
Okay.
Like, if you ask a mathematician about this thing, right, you know, x's zip with x's, like you have two sequences x's, and then you combine the two sides of that thing for every pair of elements, then you divide it, he will say, or she will say, like, this should only produce once. Because, like, you're always dividing the same number, right? The things are basically pairwise combined. Well, mm-hmm. The answer is, in this world, that will not be the case. Like, you will see random things. Because, like, there are two x's being passed into zip. What zip does internally is it does two calls to get the enumerator. Once for the left-hand side, once for the right-hand side. Which means that you have two of those random iterators going in parallel. I actually used, you know, the random thing in a static variable here. That was quite intentional. Because if I would have it sitting in here, like a local random number generator, I might be lucky that the two get enumerator calls happen close enough in time that the seed of the random number generator is the same. And you might sort of think that the thing is correct. Mm. But like the next time you show it to your boss, it doesn't produce once because you're unlucky. Like the whole thing has shifted. So if you do that, you should have guaranteed success that this thing doesn't produce the same results. Of course, it's probabilistic because, but yeah, whatever. Right? Mm-hmm. So that's not good. Like, the question is, how do you share the same iteration over x's here? Well, the answer could be you could say dot to list to materialize this whole thing, right? Now I've just enumerated it once. I have a list sitting here, and sure enough, if I iterate over a list, every time I iterate over the list, you get the same outcome,
sure.
Right? But that doesn't quite work if this thing is infinite. Like, if I wouldn't have the take 10 here, you just have an out-of-memory exception here, like, after a while. So it doesn't quite pan out. So if I want to generate just once using this thing, I need to do something to cure this random thing to share it.
Okay.
So the question is how we do that. So let's go to the observable world first to sort of show, like, the way you would actually deal with this thing over there. The answer is, well, this thing would return an iObservable, of course, and you wouldn't be able to write an iterator. You would actually write something like observable.create and just do onNext, you know, going out. Yield return is really the same as, you know, the onNext call in Rx. So you could actually write that thing, and then the way you would actually deal with this, you know, side effect elimination is by using a binding operator. You would say, I have a sequence sitting here, and you would write something like X's dot publish, oops, not R, publish, X's underscore, which is an alias for X's, and then inside the lambda body here, you can reuse that X's underscore as many times as you want. You won't duplicate the side effect of X's.
Hmm.
Because publish actually makes sure that there is only one subscription to X's, which is shared by all the subscriptions to X's underscore over here. So we basically have some sharing going on. So that's the idea of the binding operators, is to give you something of that shape. You have a source, you do some binding operator, then you get an alias to the source, and here you're sort of in a safety island.
Got it.
Where you can use that thing safely based on the policy that this thing enforces. And in this case, it's single sharing, and basically everyone can see the same values. So if this guy does on next, all the uses of X's here will see the onNext.
Excellent.
Too. So the question is, can we do that for enumerables? The answer is yes. Now, to step a little bit back, the way that those things work in observables is based on the notion of a subject.
Mm.
So the thing that really goes on if you write access.publish with that, you know, lambda expression, is it really turns into something like access.multicast. And if you look at the signature of those guys, it takes in here, one of the things it takes in is a subject. And in reality, it takes in a subject factory, like there are some other subtleties there. But the idea is you have a subject that you pass in. So what happens behind the scenes is this, like a subject is really this lollipop kind of thing. A subject is both an iObservable of T and an iObserver of T, which we write as IV of T.
Okay.
So the IV of T you can actually call onNextOn to pump something into the subject. So you can say onNext42, and here people can come in to subscribe. So the idea of multicast is like to put that subject in between the thing that produces the results and all the ones that are reading from it. And now in here you can actually enforce some policy. You can actually make sure that if the subject holds on to some sequence that actually pumps things in, that there is only one subscription to that guy, which eliminates duplication of the side effects. So like 10 people can subscribe here, but the subject can internally actually basically hold on to just one single subscription to an underlying source.
Okay.
And that's actually what the multicast to publish operators do ultimately, is like just that. So when you write, you know, access.publish and then access underscore goes to something, that access underscore is really, you know, you are looking at that subject that was inserted between you and the source, the access source on the left-hand side.
Mm.
So that's sort of the intermediate storage. So if you look at subjects, and let me actually write the interface now, you will actually clearly see how this works, because it basically the type system tells you, which is kind of nice. Like if you look at iSubject of T, and actually iSubject has a T and a U. The general form of an iSubject can have different inputs and different outputs. Typically you use T, T for same input and same output. But so it implements iObservable of T, and it implements iObserver of T. Well, iObserver of U, like this. Now, if you look at iObservable of T, the T parameter, if you would actually do F12 on this guy to go to definition, you would see that T is declared as covariant.
Hmm.
So it is declared as an output parameter, which means this thing produces T's. The way it does that is you subscribe to it, and then you get T's thrown at you. Like, from the point of view of the iObservable,
mm-hmm.
it's like sending things out. Right?
Sure.
The iObserver, if you look at the interface, it's an input interface. It's a contravariant interface in U,
mm-hmm.
which means it accepts things. Really, that's true, because like if you look at onNext, onNext takes in a T, so it's an input interface. So really what's going on is like the single source that you want to reuse is pumping things in, and then this thing is pumping it out to everyone who's listening. And so for one message coming in here, which involves side effects sort of, you know, generating that message over here, that message comes in and can be broadcasted to many people. Hence the word multicast. So publish basically does just that. Publish says, a message comes in, I broadcast it to everyone who's, you know, listening to that sequence inside that lambda island.
Mm.
Things like replay do something else. Like replay say, all the messages that come in here will actually store in an intermediate buffer here, and all the guys that are subscribing from the outside get to see that whole buffer. Like if somebody joins the party, like 10 minutes late,
mm-hmm.
he will still see the whole past of
I
the
see.
Thing, because there is an internal buffer. You can bound that thing based on a certain length. So those are actually the operators that you have sitting there, the binding operators. So what's the equivalent in enumerables? That's the big question. Well, naively you might say, well, let's just dualize this guy, and then where do you end up, right? Well, the dual of iObservable is iEnumerable.
Yep.
Pretty good. So let's actually say, I will write it here, iEnumerable of T. And the dual of iObserver of T is iEnumerator of T. iEnumerator of T, we actually abbreviate as IR of T.
Okay.
So iEnumerable and iEnumerator. I have those two guys sitting here now. Well, if you look at the interface, something doesn't quite line up. Because if you look at both of those guys, you will basically see that both of those things are output interfaces.
Ah, yes.
Like move next, current currently turns a T. That's output. This guy, if you think about it, if you interact with an enumerable,
mm-hmm.
it's actually sending messages out. Like you do a move next, ultimately get the enumerator. You give nothing in, you get an enumerator back. You do a move next, you get a T back. It's also an output interface. Like traffic cannot really flow if all the directions are outgoing.
Mm.
Like, you know, like if everyone is leaving the city, ultimately the city will be empty, right? Like, so there's no way to actually combine those two guys into a subject, like an enumerable subject. So what are we missing, like, to make this work? Well, first of all, let's see what we need. The thing we definitely need is, like, people on the outside want to look at that shared kind of thing, that shared sequence, by means of the enumerable. Because, like, if it wouldn't be an enumerable, it wouldn't be compositional anymore. All the operators live here.
Okay.
Like, that's sort of where the money is. Like, we can't actually leave that out, right?
Sure.
So we need that guy.
Yep.
Now, the question is, how do things get into that subject? Or to that, you know, kind of shared space? Well, one option would be to combine an enumerable with an iObserver, which means somebody needs to pump things into an iObserver, and then people can fish it out using the enumerator, or the enumerable on the outside.
Hmm.
So that would work, but then the question is, who's pumping things into the iObserver? Like, there needs to be somebody calling move next. Now, if you really look at the enumerable world, the only place where there is a stimulus to the system to do something is on the behalf of the user training the sequence. User comes in, says move next, and things happen. Like, there's nothing else that's basically pushing things in, because then you're in the observable world anyway. Then you would be, you know, doing things on the unobservable. So this side of the coin is really a little, you know, weird if you combine it or compare it to a subject. A subject implements the input part because that's darn convenient. Like, you can give a subject to a subscribe, and it can pump things in because it's an observer.
Mm.
So it's implementing that guy, really, because it's very convenient. But, like, on this side, implementing this thing wouldn't make sense, because, like, it's about pushing things in, and there's nothing that's pushing in the system. It's only pool-based. And implementing this thing, well, totally doesn't make sense. So, really, if you step a little bit back and look behind the scenes, what the subject is, it's like something that holds on to an observer. It just happens to implement it for convenience reasons, but it's something that's an observable to the outside world, but internally it sort of has something that can receive messages.
Sure.
Here you could say the same thing. Like, the jewel to the subject would be something that definitely exposes my enumerable, but it would hold on to a shared enumerator over the underlying sequence. So you have the underlying sequence, like in this case, the random number generator.
Mm-hmm.
What you really want to have happen is access.getEnumerator. Enumerator is called just once. Not more than once, just once, because otherwise you're duplicating the side effects of this iteration. So what you need is something that, if you queue random with this, you know, policy of some kind of subject thing, like, say that you would be able to write publish here. If you do random.publish, it needs to be an enumerable. And, you know, when somebody comes in to ask for an enumeration on top of that guy, there should only be one get enumerator call to the underlying sequence, to the random
thing. To the random generator, yeah.
And so that's actually the constraints. And so we actually captured those using the notion of, and now it comes, an iBuffer of T. That's the current name of the thing. And so an iBuffer of T is an iEnumerable of T, but internally it actually holds on to an iEnumerator of T.
Mm-hmm.
This is the shared underlying cursor on the underlying sequence.
Okay.
And so on top of that, you can actually build a number of operators. And so just to sketch the operators that actually exist, mm-hmm. there are, if I'm not mistaken, three, and there will be a fourth one that
now, just to make sure that I'm not insane, I mean,
yep.
in some sense, that is an interactive extension.
Yep.
And that's the whole point.
Yep, too.
Just wanted to kind of tie the
knots
together.
Oh, yeah, so this is the
So you're
IX,
using interact, yes, exactly.
That's the IX notion that's dual to the RX notion of a subject.
Absolutely. Perfect.
Yep. So okay. The operators we have on top of that, well, not on top of the iBuffer, but that use an iBuffer internally,
mm-hmm.
are actually publish, memoize, and share. Those are the main ones.
Okay.
So what do they do, right? That's the question. Say that you, they will all be of the same shape. You do access.publish, access underscore goes to, and now the question is, in here, what's the policy enforced on access underscore? How can you use it, and how does it influence that guy? So for publish, the idea is as follows. If inside this block of code you do a get enumerator call,
mm-hmm.
you basically tune in to the current cursor of the underlying sequence. What does that mean? Well, basically what happens is when you do publish, we get an enumerator over this guy, which will be shared across all the access uses over here.
Okay.
Now, say that there is a first guy joining the party here. Inside this code, there is somebody, some operator, like you know, you could use zip or any kind of operator that's doing access underscore dot get enumerator. At that point, he actually says, from this point on in the underlying sequence, I want to receive elements. So if the underlying sequence looks like this, right, and it goes on and on, the first guy comes in and he says, I actually tune in to this spot in the sequence. That means that all the cells from that point on need to be live for that enumerator over access underscore. Because he says, I want to enumerate from this point on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that guy says, you know, I have an enumerator and he starts moving, so that guy says, move next, move next, move next, what's really happening is that the sequence underneath is moving as well. Because he's training that sequence, right? So his cursor is actually moving on to get elements out of the underlying source. Like in this case, it would be calling the random number generator.
Mm.
If a second guy comes in now, so actually that was the guy was moving, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the guy was moving. Now a second guy joins the party. And he says, I want to do access underscore get enumerator. He basically gets the last, you know, the last cell inside the buffer. He actually puts his cursor on. And so that guy now keeps the rest of the sequence alive from that point on. So the first guy can still be moving. The first guy can say, I do move next, move next, move next. Like move next, move next, move next. He's moving.
Mm-hmm.
But those cells in the buffer cannot be reclaimed yet. Because this guy is lagging behind. The second guy says, I want to enumerate starting from this point on. So that guy still has an enumerator that keeps those cells alive. Now, if that guy actually moves on to the next cell, those cells can be reclaimed. So basically, it's a multiple readers on top of the same buffer.
Mm.
And actually, the one that's the furthest behind actually keeps the rest of the sequence alive.
Okay.
But if the last one moves on, you know, it doesn't keep that value. So the buffer can actually be reclaimed.
Okay.
So, exercise for the Niners would be to do this, you know, access.publish, access underscore goes to, and then you basically insert this piece of code. So this piece of code, access underscore, zip, access underscore, comma, LNR.
Okay.
So you insert that piece of code in this lambda and ask yourself what needs to happen in that case.
Okay.
So we are publishing the sequence and we are zipping the two things with each other. You need to know how zip actually moves. Like zip will actually do get enumerator on the left, get enumerator on the right.
Mm-hmm.
And then it will do move next on the left, move next on the right. How does that work? Well, the key here is when the get enumerator calls happen determines the rest of the sequence. Because at that point you sort of claim, you know, that part of the sequence to be yours. Like
okay.
You keep the rest alive. Let's now look at share. Share does the following. Access share, access underscore goes to something. What really happens here is that, again, you have a single enumerator over access, but any enumerator over access underscore shares that underlying enumerator using consumption. What does that mean? Like, if you have five users here pulling at access underscore, they will basically cooperatively drain the entire sequence and no one will see the same values. So what that means is like for every call to move next on any enumerator over access underscore, any guy who does move next here moves the buffer to the next value.
Mm.
And nobody else sees that value. So it's like one producer, multiple consumers.
Yeah.
And like you have the guarantee that values are not received by many readers here.
Hmm.
You know, every value ends up with one of the readers. So that's basically if you introduce concurrency here, for example, like say that you have 10 threads actually doing get enumerated move next on axis underscore,
mm-hmm.
you really have 10 readers that are training that sequence.
Okay.
And there is, of course, some big lock around to move next on the axis to make sure that, you know, those things do not clash.
Mm.
But so that thing doesn't have any storage internally. It doesn't have this, you know, huge array with a cursor and everything. Like the only thing it has is the enumerator over axis. It has the enumerator here, I enumerator of t, and that's the only thing, together with an object to lock on.
Hmm.
And like every time somebody does a move next here, a move next happens there, the value is given to that guy, and that's the end
so
of
what's
the lifetime.
So what's the use case of wanting to use share?
Uh-huh.
So give me an example of...
The use case of share would be if you really have something that can process messages concurrently here.
Okay.
So then you could actually say, you know, access.share, and then multiple readers here can party on top of that. Also, if you're not interested in the order of those guys, you might do that. You might say, like, I just need to get all the values, but I don't care about the order of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you have many intertwined readers on top of that access underscore, like, you can just use this.
Okay.
Yeah. Then memoise, that's actually the one that most people actually like a lot. That's actually one of the top requests, you know, when we brought IX back, is like, please give us memoise. So we actually did.
Great.
Originally, we had memoise all as well, and I will actually explain where that one has gone. But so access memoise, access underscore goes to, basically is a little bit like publish, but the lifetime of the sequence is actually from the beginning. So what does that mean? Every enumerator that actually sits in here, like every guy who does a get enumerator on this thing,
mm-hmm.
gets to see the sequence all the way from the start. It's like a replay subject in Rx. You could actually recall this thing replay.
Absolutely.
But then people would say, well, the name has changed, you know, and memoise is
got
kind
it.
Of a
fair enough. Memoise is kind of cool.
Yeah.
All right.
So so it's really the closest to replay.
Okay.
Now,
certainly sounds like it.
Yeah. So if you do like, you know, access underscore zip, access underscore here, it would definitely work because it's like a lazy to list in some sense. Like this thing is really, when somebody asks like the last reader, you know, the reader the furthest away,
mm-hmm.
they'll actually pull at the underlying sequence. Like if you know, the one that's the furthest away says move next and there's no element in the buffer yet, it will just go to the source sequence access. That thing gives me the next element and the buffer is appended. But the buffer never disappears on the left-hand side. Like, it never actually deletes things. So that means it's like, it's also like a memory hole, right? Like, you know, you're basically saying, just keep all the sequence values. Now, in case of access zip, access underscore, like those two, you know, used of access, like, you might say, do I really need to keep the whole buffer alive? Not really, because like zip is sort of looking at one element at a time and then it moves on and it doesn't need to see the past element anymore. Now, of course, if you do something like access.skip5, zip access, then you have one that's five elements behind and you have one that's sitting at the current element. So you have sort of a little bit lag there, like you need to keep the buffer a little longer alive. So the question is, what's the policy to reclaim this thing? So the default memoise actually doesn't reclaim anything. That means it just eats memory till the point that the sequence ends. And if the sequence is finite, that's fine. At that point, you know, the buffer will go away.
Mm-hmm.
If you lose the reference to access memoise. The other thing is you can pass into memoise, you can pass in the number of readers that you actually will actually have inside this island over here. So you can say memoise with two readers. What does that mean? That actually means that the buffer starts here, and now we know that there will be two readers on top of the buffer. So, you know, we go to the random number generator and we get the value 7. Now, the first reader that's sitting here actually will see 7 coming out, but there will be some ref count associated with this thing that says initially, when I get the value, there are two readers still that want to see that thing. Now, the left-hand side of zip comes in and says, give me the next value.
Mm.
We go to the buffer and we see 7 is the next value, because your cursor is sitting here. So we actually see, well, you will get, you know, value 7. We decrement this thing to 1. Then the next guy, the right-hand side of SIP says, give me the next value. That guy says, okay, I can give you the next value for you, because all of those guys have their own cursor to the underlying buffer. That guy will say, well, the next value for me is, actually, I should draw both of them, right? Like left and the right-hand side. So the left-hand side was sitting here. He did move next to refcon 21. And now that one is actually moved on, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the next value he will read. The right-hand side is still, you know, processing, so the right-hand side needs to do move next. He's still sitting here. That guy does a move next. As part of the move next, he gets to C7. We decrement the ref count to that cell to 0, and the cursor moves to the next thing. Now, at the point the cursor moves, and we see that the ref count is 0, that cell in the buffer gets totally erased.
Okay.
Actually gets reclaimed. So you see that there are two readers here. As soon as two readers have seen the element in the buffer, that part of the buffer can be reclaimed. So that's actually the memoized behavior. It's a little different from the replay behavior. We might actually introduce the replay behavior at some point as well.
Hmm.
If we do access.replay, replay takes in an int as well in Rx. The int there is the length of the buffer,
okay,
like how much elements to keep. Which means at the point somebody comes in and subscribes to the sequence, in this case when somebody does a get enumerator, he will see that much of the buffer sort of lagging behind. That's the maximum, you know, time travel he can do to the back of the buffer.
Okay.
But so with memoise, it's the number of readers that you want to have in that island. And so if you do that again with the zip thing, the question is, like, what's the difference between publish, memoise, and share if you do this piece of code with zip? So that's actually an exercise.
That's a challenge.
It's a challenge, yes.
Excellent. I think it's a good one.
Yep.
You hear that, so. Niners? I'm sure Exoteric and Stacy W. And
Al.
Al, absolutely. Yep. They're going to party on this, man.
Yep.
And so post your answers, guys and girls, because mm-hmm. I'm sure there's other people's names that didn't mention, which is the problem with ever mentioning names. So
yes.
No offense to
mm-hmm.
people. Very, very good. I think it's crystal clear. Came out to find out more about interactive extensions.
Yep.
We got a nice IQ observable bonus plus sort
exactly.
of a connection.
Yep.
And now we know that in some sense an interactive extension solves the problem of using enumerators which don't have the contravariant capability that you had mentioned.
Yes.
Ins.
Yep. Exactly. Yep.
And so you would use a interactive extension model pattern
mm-hmm.
with
yep.
your iBuffer. And play around with these operators that BART has, of course,
mm-hmm.
you know, the binding operators.
Yep.
So binding operators are all about chaining side effects.
Yeah.
Controlling them,
like
exactly.
putting some policy on top of them. It's like the let binding in F-sharp, right?
Yeah.
You say, like, you know, let x equals something in some expression, you're basically sharing that x in that expression. So it's all about sharing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, thanks for sharing information with us, buddy.
It's my pleasure.
We'll come back and talk to you again soon.
Sounds good.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.